I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. International trade, federal food aid, and regional drought are just a few of the influences impacting the daily lives and livelihoods of Midwesterners. Today, the Harvest Public Media reporting team shares the latest food and farming news from across the heartland. Then, in 1967, the Beatles went from mop-topped heartthrobs to rock intellectuals with the release of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. It signaled the birth of classic rock, or so says music critic Stephen Hayden. He'll help us chart the course of the genre and its iconic superstars, and we'll ask what the future looks like for classic rock. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. The farm may be out of sight, out of mind for a lot of us city dwellers, but it remains very much at the center of a lot of policy debate in Washington and around the country these days. For instance, lawmakers in Washington are considering whether to require welfare recipients to work for the food benefits they receive. And hog producers out here in farm country are bracing for trouble now that China has slapped a tariff on pork. Now, a windmill conversation about some of the big issues on the farm. With us are three reporters who cover farm country for Harvest Public Media, which is based here at KCUR. Amy Mayer is based at Iowa Public Radio up in Ames. Amy, good morning.
Good morning.
Madeline Beck is a regional Illinois reporter based in Galesburg. Madeline, good morning.
Morning.
Grant Gerlach is Harvest Public Media's reporter at NET News in Nebraska. Grant, nice to have you.
Good morning, Steve.
Well, broadly speaking, how much upheaval is going on in farm country these days? And you know, we've got concerns about drought. We've got these new tariffs. NAFTA is being renegotiated. A new farm bill is in the works. What do farmers, Amy, and ranchers, for that matter, say about all this stuff going on?
I think one thing to keep in mind is that right now farmers are primarily focused on getting their crops in the ground, feeding their livestock every day.
They're the basics to worry about here, right?
I mean, really, farmers are very focused on the day-to-day, and it's true that they are increasingly dialed into world markets and political nuance, but they do tend to take a broad view and a long view. They're concerned about each growing season, each herd of livestock. But it is true that the economy has been down in many sectors in farm country, and they are very concerned about what sorts of changes may come in the next farm bill, which is currently being debated.
I was going to say, Madeline, this is just a lot of unsettlement out there. People, they can't count on much right now, can they? They don't know where the world's going.
Well, they don't, and that includes the weather. I just pulled up the latest drought map, and it looks like May is a really crucial month that a lot of climatologists have said that basically they know if we're into a really deep drought, if it starts getting really bad middle or end of May. So far, we're looking pretty good in Illinois. It's just starting to creep back in there, but southern Iowa, northern Missouri are looking a little worse. Kansas, not great. A lot of drought, especially in the southern part of the state going into
Oklahoma.
That's
hard for those of us in Kansas City to recognize because it's been pretty rainy here, pretty damp the last few weeks. But you're saying the word drought is still very much operative in farm country right now.
Oh, very much so. And I mean, it definitely depends. There are regions that are getting rain. This changes all the time. This latest drought monitor was from May 10th. So that was a few days ago. We could have a giant rainstorm any day. But drought is still playing a huge factor. If you don't have enough inches of rain, even if you have one good rainstorm, it might not be several rainstorms you needed over the course of a month or two.
Yeah. Grant, what are you hearing from the farmers you're talking to out there?
Well, they would like to see some of these loose ends be tied up.
I can imagine.
If NAFTA could be tied up in a way that doesn't really disrupt their interest selling corn to Mexico and so on, they'd really like to just see that taken off the table, one less thing to worry about.
Mm-hmm.
When this trade dispute with China sort of began to take shape, they really wanted their lawmakers to hear them and hear their concerns. One of our senators in Nebraska, Ben Sass, came back to Omaha and had a roundtable with farmers, and they really just wanted to be heard and make sure that he understood and that the message got to the administration that we're putting this crop in the ground, we'd like to know that when we harvest it several months from now, that this has already been dealt with. So there is that time window where maybe by the time harvest comes around, this has all been wrapped up and things look copacetic with China and it's back to the way it was. But until then, yeah, while they're in the field and planting, there's going to be this thought in the back of their mind, which way is this going to lean in the end?
To what extent does this talk of tariff send terror through farm country? What do you pick up?
Well, it sends definitely a lot of concern. Keep in mind, the big crop here is primarily soybeans. That's the big crop that we send to China, and China does have some options that we've seen them show at least interest in pursuing, going to South America to get their soybeans instead of coming to the United States. Is that just them sort of demonstrating their options to impact negotiations? We don't know for sure.
But if the tariff goes into, you know, if it continues, what happens then? What's the impact?
Well, so if we start selling fewer soybeans to China, that just sort of trickles backwards in that whole supply chain. Where are these soybeans going to go if they aren't going to China?
Where would they go?
Well, that's a good question. I'm sure there are some people who would like to use them in the United States, but they've already got the supply they need. So it starts to stack up and build up an extra supply, an abundant oversupply, and that's where you would see it impact the farmer's price.
And prices drop like crazy. Yeah. Do you want to hop in here?
Well, one way that we see a lot of grain as it piles up is it brings down the cost of feed for livestock. And so there's a tiny window where hog farmers and beef feedlot operators would see a decrease in their production costs, and potentially there could be some price impacts on meat. That is a small benefit, but the quantity of soybeans that we export specifically to China is still much greater than the domestic market could absorb. And so I've heard some little conversations about where else might we sell some of those soybeans abroad, but there's nobody, and probably not even a collection of countries, that can consume the amount that China has historically been buying.
But what do countries use soybeans for?
Primarily to feed livestock.
Okay, that's where it winds up going.
For the most part, yeah. There's some other uses, but that's the main one.
You know, Madeline, farm country these days, the economy, is this a good time in farm country, a Midland time? How would you characterize it broadly?
Not great, not terrible, not great. And it's been that way for the last couple of years here.
And why is it that way?
It's that way just because of kind of global forces for the most part. Grant, you might be able to talk about that.
The oversupply of grain when it comes to the corn and soybeans, some of that apparently is being alleviated, but it's on the marginal scale. So, you know, farmers may see corn go up 10 cents here, 10 cents there, but they're really, you know, probably a dollar lower than where they'd like to be to actually be making something of a profit. Yeah,
it's got to be a hard business. If you don't know you're going to make money for all the work you're putting in during the course of a growing season that lasts months, I don't know how you deal with that.
Farmers understand that they'll go through periods where they're not making a lot of money. It's happened before. The 90s were sort of a lot like this in terms of where profits were, where they really had to look at all their costs and scrape it down to just what they needed in order to make the whole business work and stay in the black. So a lot of the farmers, since they are experienced, have gone through this kind of thing before and can adjust their operations accordingly. The folks who are feeling the most stress are the ones who had the most debt, whether they're new farmers or have been established for a while. If they took out a lot of debt and are trying to pay it back at the same time that they're trying to control costs and manage this lower income that they have coming in.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking with three reporters from Harvest Public Media about life in farm country and the economy out there. Madeline, I want to come back to you about the drought before I walk away from it altogether, because I want to read a sentence from a story you wrote in February. You wrote this: "The worry is also widespread, considering the reach of this winter's drought is even worse than in 2012, a year that brought the worst drought in the U.S. since the Dust Bowl, and cost farmers, ranchers, and governments an estimated $30 billion. That sounds pretty serious.
It is very serious, and that's why everyone's kind of watching this drought monitor map so closely. Back then, though, I mean, even at the time I was doing that story, it was a different part of Illinois that was facing drought.
The western side, I think, you were talking.
Yeah, it was the central western part, so mm-hmm. Jerseyville, right north of St. Louis. So that area was the ones that were facing drought. Now it's shifted north, to the northwest part of that state. So, I mean, it was worse earlier this winter. And so it's gotten better, but now it's getting worse again. It's so variant. And the thing is, we're now in a part of a cycle that the state climatologist in that story I talked to, the Illinois state climatologist, said, we do expect a few more droughts in the Midwest, but we also expect more extreme rain events. So you'll have maybe this shorter time of drought. In the West, it's just going to be more drought. In the Midwest, it's going to be shorter periods of drought followed by these massive rain events that are just clouds and storm systems much larger than they'd seen historically in the Midwest.
That's all climate change stuff, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
And all this is such a huge concern out in western Kansas, where the Ogallala Aquifer has been low and people worry about that endlessly out there, Amy.
One thing I also wanted to bring to mind is in 2012, when we had that really severe drought, corn prices and soybean prices, but corn prices in particular, went through the roof. And one thing that farmers understand probably better than those of us who don't farm is that these subtleties Madeline described about one county or region versus another, they can mean what is a devastating year for one group of farmers can be a boom year for others. And so, I mean, nobody wants anybody to have a bad year, but all farmers recognize that if someone else is having a bad year, that may translate to a good year for you. So the farm economy cycles often opposite the overall economy, but also individual farms' economies don't necessarily follow the same trajectory.
Yeah.
And that's a really difficult, when you're talking about projecting out what a season is going to look like, it's difficult for farmers to think that, you know, somebody else's loss could be my gain, but they all sort of know that. And each year it's different. So what's bad for one farmer one year, the next year they may be the one who has the benefit.
I was going to say, one thing that hasn't changed in farm country over the decades is this boom and bust cycle that just, as you guys are describing here, it's just the way the world works out there.
Which, like Madeline said, is partly weather, it's partly climate change trends, it's partly that all of these political decisions that are made in hallways at any time during the year have an impact at certain times in the farm growing season. But yeah, I mean, like Grant said, the more experience a farmer has, the more accustomed they are to some of these ebbs and flows. And there are increasingly tools available for farmers to try to mitigate the lowness of the lows and the highness of the highs. You know, they can do things like work with experts or bankers or other professionals to consider how they contract their grain, for example. Mm-hmm. It's risky to lock in a price, but sometimes that's the best way to reduce risk later. You know, things like that that are much more accessible now than they were, you know, for the older generation.
You know, Grant, Kansas Senator Pat Roberts is very much engaged in crafting a new farm bill going forward. These bills cover several years. Do we expect much change as a result of what this next farm bill, what might be in it? I'm not hearing a lot that it's going to be result in a dramatic shift in the way farm country works.
When it comes to the farm policies that farmers are most keyed in on, crop insurance, conservation programs, the payments for poor crops and poor crop prices, most of those programs are not seeing much change. There is one conservation program that some farmers like to see stick around. It's being folded into another one. But for the most part, that's not where the big changes are. And we'd like to see Senator Roberts' bill, so anytime he wants to come out with it. The Senate hasn't come out with their version of the Farm Bill yet, but the House has. And we do see some significant changes in the House version of the bill when it comes to nutrition programs, namely SNAP, a federal food assistance for low-income folks.
And there's talk that recipients of SNAP may have to work to get those benefits going forward. That's one policy question that lawmakers are debating in Washington right now.
It's really the policy question that will determine where it goes. The House is trying to come up with the votes for the Farm Bill this week. And so far, indications are that they haven't gotten them because of the debate over these work requirements. Right now, the people who have to work to stay in SNAP are they're referred to as ABODs, able-bodied adults without dependents. And since a welfare reform in 1996, they've had to work at least 20 hours a week or be in a training program or be volunteering some qualifying work. And they can stay in SNAP. But if they go for 3 months without doing that, then they could lose SNAP. They want to, in the House version of the bill, they want to expand that to include a lot more people, a wider range in age range from 18 to 59 years old, and also some parents with kids who are older than 6 years old. And that would increase it from about 3.5 million people to up to 7 million people if that expansion occurs.
So how controversial is this?
Well, it's controversial enough to potentially keep the farm bill from being passed in the House. And that's not necessarily because of opposition to work requirements. A lot of the people who aren't voting for it is because they don't think the work requirements are strong enough.
Wow. Interesting. Madeline, you had an interesting story about this concern that Midwestern farmers have actually wound up contributing to climate change by the way they plant their crops. Tell us about that.
Yeah, and I mean, some people have stumbled upon this as part of an economic thing. It's just no-till, the effort to just not till your property.
Just for stick the seeds in the ground.
Yeah, and the difference there is that plants basically can absorb carbon from the air and then put that into their roots, and then when they die, they just stay in the ground. If you till, that carbon can come up as emissions back into the air. And so those who've been doing no-till, usually because it's more economic for them, honestly, some areas it's less economic, so they're not doing no-till, they're still tilling. So if this was made a global effort, there are researchers who believe it would be a contributor to easing climate change, just because CO2 emissions are such a big driver there. But at the same time, one thing to be very careful of is someone who might not do till for a couple of years and then might till again, you're going to release all of that you just stored up.
Oh, okay.
So this would have to be a permanent change for it to make any big difference.
But it's one big task off a farmer's to-do list, though, if they opt to go no-till.
Well, I mean, it depends. You have Amy's over there shaking her head. Yeah.
Yes and no.
Well, why is it yes and no?
Well, farmers have their systems. And if a system involves tilling before planting, that's one thing. If they change it to no-till, it's not that they then just don't till and do everything else the same way. They would make other changes to ensure that the seed gets in at the depth that they want. Maybe they need to adjust their machinery slightly differently because they're going over the old stalks or leaves or whatever from the previous season. I think it's an adjustment, but it's not necessarily we have one less thing to do at planting season.
Yeah. Grant, I wanted to ask you about the conflicting interests in some places in rural America when it comes to President Trump's trade policies. You visited Cozad, Nebraska, where these tensions between the needs of farmers and then the blue-collar workers also there played out pretty clearly. Tell us about that.
Well, one reason I wanted to go to Cozad is because I think a lot of times we forget that there is a lot of manufacturing out in rural areas. They're making grain bins. They're making, in Cozad, they were making struts for cars and even for like the struts that keep your windows open or keep the hatch open on your car when you lift it up. And when you think about the dynamics of NAFTA, where it's so beneficial for farmers to sell their crops overseas, but it may not be beneficial for those jobs building those struts to go overseas. So it's an interesting example of where there's just sort of a conflicting dynamic within that community.
And how's that playing out? I mean, is there any resolution to it, or does it just continue?
Oh, it just continues.
Yeah.
In the sense that, it's a community that keeps looking for how to replace that plant. And will they do it by doubling down with agriculture and looking for other ag-related businesses to bring in? They would have liked to find another company to move into that manufacturing plant, but that didn't happen. And they ended up tearing it down.
You know, Amy, you had a story not long ago about another issue in rural America, and that's a shortage of lawyers. How is that being managed? Because there's some interesting steps being taken there.
What I learned is that as bar associations in some of the states that have large rural areas have looked at this question of bringing more lawyers into practice, is rural access to justice committees have tried to figure out what are the hurdles and how can they resolve them. And one of the hurdles is the cost. A lot of people are representing themselves in court just because they can't afford a lawyer. That's true in rural and urban areas. But in rural areas, it's also often the case that there aren't any lawyers who can take on these cases. It's also really difficult for a law student with a lot of student loan debt to move to a rural area not knowing whether they're going to be able to have enough business, or maybe there's an attorney who would like to retire, but lawyers can't like sell their business to someone else because clients choose who they go to. So this concept of unbundled legal services is a method of allowing a client to come in and say, for example, I'm getting divorced and I don't want to pay you $5,000 to do my entire divorce. My soon-to-be ex and I have worked out lots of things, but we need help with this piece of it. And so they can just pay for the piece of the legal service that they need. The lawyer writes a very specific agreement, so it's clear to everybody what the client is paying for. And that way, the clients feel a little bit more in control of the process. They know going in how much it's going to cost instead of it being a sort of open-ended and questionable thing. It also can limit the number of times you need to meet with a lawyer. So if you do have to travel a little ways, maybe you only have to do that once instead of several times.
A la carte lawyering, we're talking about.
Exactly.
Here,
right? Yeah.
Okay, we'll leave our conversation there. I want to thank our good reporters here from Harvest Public Media based here at KCUR. Amy Mayer, based at Iowa Public Radio in Ames. Madeline Beck, a regional Illinois reporter in Galesburg. Grant Gerlach, he's our Nebraska reporter. Thank you all very much for a good conversation. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Time for a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about classic rock and roll and is there still a future for it? I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. On yesterday's show, we spoke with a couple of prominent Kansas Democrats about the future of their party in the red state of Kansas. You can hear that conversation and others at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow on the program, we'll talk about something I know a little about, and it's not politics or jazz, it's hip replacements. Tomorrow on Up to Date, hear about the latest advances in joint replacements and physical therapy. Legends of rock and roll are fading from the scene. David Bowie is gone. So are Prince and Tom Petty and exactly one half of the Beatles. Left behind are diehard fans like Stephen Hayden, who's left wondering about the future of classic rock, how enduring it'll be, and what do the great rock gods have left to teach us. Stephen Hayden is a rock writer at Up Rocks. Among the publications he's written for are Rolling Stone, Pitchfork, Slate, and Salon. He's also the author of Your Favorite Band is Killing Me. He joins us this morning from the studios of Minnesota Public Radio. Stephen, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
How important was this album by the Beatles that was released way back in 1967?
Well, we're talking about Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, and it really marks the dividing line between, I guess, early rock and roll, which was music that was associated with teenagers, Elvis Presley, Chuck Berry, Little Richard, all those people, and rock music, which was made by people that were trying to create self-conscious works of art. You know, and Sgt. Pepper was the first rock record that was perceived that way, written about that way, and talked about that way by fans.
Some folks say this was the greatest rock and roll album ever made. You buy it?
No, I don't think it's even the best Beatles record. I would put Revolver, Rubber Soul, I like the White Album, Abbey Road. It's like fifth or sixth for me. But I think in terms of how we think about albums, it is incredibly influential. It definitely inspired people to think about music in terms of albums and making that kind of statement.
So where did your love of this genre of classic rock and roll come from, Stephen?
Well, I think one thing that makes my book a little bit different, you know, because there's a lot of books about classic rock. I mean, you could fill a library
sure.
with books about classic rock. But, you know, I'm a member of Generation X. You know, I'm 40 years old. So I came to this music through classic rock radio when I was a teenager. And, you know, at that point, Led Zeppelin had been broken up for 10 years. The Beatles had been broken up for 20 years. You know, Jimi Hendrix had died. Janis Joplin had died. A lot of those rock legends were no longer with us. And yet there are a lot of people like me and younger, you know, millennials, who came to this music because it was on the radio all the time. You know, you could turn on the radio and you could hear the latest hits of the time, but you would also hear Hotel California. You would hear Born to Run. And you would also hear those songs in ballparks and at gas stations. And, you know, it was music that was in the atmosphere once we reached a certain point in our culture. So I think it's different for people my age looking at these rock stars. In a way, for me, they were like Marvel superheroes. Mm-hmm. You know, Keith Richards, Robert Plant,
right.
Pete Townsend. I read about them in books. And they were these distant figures. And, you know, they were still alive, and I knew that they had gotten older and they had changed. But in my imagination, they were still the people that they were in the 60s and 70s. And I think that's a common experience. I think a lot of people still love this music, even if they weren't around when it was originally created. That's why these bands are still playing arenas even now.
I'm so struck by the fact that you fell for it by listening to it on the radio, as so many people did. But that meant, of course, that somebody, you know, someone else was curating the music you were listening to. You know, in the internet age, when people can feast on anything they want, anytime they want, what does that say about our ability to, you know, elevate a limited number of artists to deity status, as was the case when I was a kid and certainly when you were too?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really great point, and that's something I talk about in the book, about how before the internet, you know, the way that you discovered music was through the radio and through music magazines with rock criticism, and that was my entry point into learning about music. And it really was easier to kind of create these narratives, you know, about who the great artists were and the great albums, and, you know, create this mythic status for people, this mystique. Because there were fewer gatekeepers, and the gatekeepers, you know, were not as diverse as they are now. So, you know, now this music is in a way a lot more accessible than it was for me. Like, I had to ride my bike to the record store in my town. I lived in a small Midwestern town,
right?
You know, and it was like a Lord of the Rings type journey. You know, you get on your bike and you're going up hills and you're going through traffic. And it was like a big deal just to get one record that you maybe read about or you'd heard on the radio.
Right.
Whereas now, you know, if you want to learn about Pink Floyd or Led Zeppelin or any of these bands, all you need to do is like read a Wikipedia entry and go on Spotify and you could become an expert in a matter of a day or two. You know, so I think that did change. I think it's a much more sort of, it's a bigger world now, I think, than it was then.
Yeah, you wonder if it's a better world, because I think your point is so well taken. This notion of mythic status, to use your phrase, that was attached to so many of those artists like Led Zeppelin and the Beatles. You know, my sense, and it's, you know, it's just my sense, that stars today seem far more real, far more down to earth, far more approachable. And I'm wondering if that's true, what's been lost, or has anything been lost here?
Well, you know, it's like anything. There are trade-offs. I would say that if you had told me as a 14-year-old that I could go to a box in my house and punch in any record I'd ever heard of and it would be at my fingertips in seconds, I would have taken that deal. Like, at the time, I didn't romanticize having to, like, go through all this rigmarole to get music. When I look back on it, I romanticize it because I think about how much it made me value the music,
you know,
and how it built it up in my mind. But, I mean, generally, I think things are better now. I think it is better to have that access. I think that, you know, the difference is that I think when you're young and you're encountering art for the first time, things have a way of building up mythic status on their own, you know, because everything is fresh to you.
Right.
And you have a way of imagining that the world is being invented for the first time as you're discovering it. You know, you don't have a sense that things were kind of the same way as they always were before you learned about it. You know, you think, well, if I've heard it now, that means it's brand new. And then you get older and things aren't as fresh, and then they seem maybe a little stayed or right. not as special anymore. And that doesn't have anything to do with the art. It has to do with you as a person. So I think that's wrapped up in this as well. You know, as you get yeah. older, your perception of these things change.
But can any piece of music become classic today when it's so widely accessible? I mean, it does cheapen the music. At least it has, you know, I do an Apple Music thing at home in the evening. And when everything is free or relatively free, it's what, $10 a month, you know, it loses its currency somehow. It's lost it for me. And again, your point about my age is a relevant one. But I wonder about that sometimes.
Well, you know, one of the things I explore in the book is trying to define what classic rock is.
Right.
Because it's not anything that anyone can really agree on. It's a nebulous term, and it really doesn't refer to anything specific. It's not like it's an actual genre of music. It really started out as a radio format in the early 80s. You know, the radio stations were trying to reach a certain demographic, you know, listeners in their 30s and 40s, and they hit upon this generation of bands that were popular and they knew their listeners would like. And those same bands stayed in the format for decades after that. So you have this generation of bands that gets codified as classic rock. The Eagles, Fleetwood Mac, Zeppelin, Pink Floyd, Bruce Springsteen, all of those acts. And it's not necessarily a value judgment, because there's a lot of great rock music that doesn't get grouped under that umbrella. But it ends up being something that elevates those bands. They're considered classic rock because radio at some point said they were classic rock, but because they're on the radio all the time, that's what makes them timeless. Mm-hmm. You know, they get reintroduced mm-hmm. to a new audience all of the time. So it becomes almost a self-fulfilling prophecy in a way. I mean, what we have now is that music is always there no matter what. You know, it's not packaged in a way where you're only going to hear this music and nothing else. We have a thing with Spotify and Apple Music and all these streaming platforms where if you are 12 years old and just getting into music, you can listen to Cardi B just as easily as you can listen to the Beatles.
Right.
You could put them on the same playlist if you want. You can program your own radio station and create your own sort of genre of good music or whatever you want to call it. So that's going to be interesting to see how that influences how we remember this stuff going forward. You know, I think that remains to be seen. Certainly, you know, the thing with the radio, like in my book, I think this runs through a lot of things in my book where, you know, I'm romanticizing certain things because it's how I was raised, but I'm also critiquing it at the same time. And with radio, there was a lot of terrible things with radio. I mean, there was a lot of payola going on with radio. There were, you know, record labels that were pushing these arena rock bands like REO Speedwagon over bands like The Clash because they were getting Rolex watches and microwave yeah. ovens and drugs and all this other stuff. But at the same time, my mom loves REO Speedwagon. That's a genuine love that she has. So it's both sort of an industry construct, and it's also transcendent at the same time. You know, you have to entertain both of those thoughts in your head with this stuff.
I'm visiting with Stephen Hyden. He's author of Twilight of the Gods, that looks back at classic rock and its relevance today. If you want to join our conversation, we'd like to have you. We're wondering, what is the relevance of classic rock and roll today, and is it going to fade away? 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Again, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date, and we'll get your call in here when we can. Another staple of the classic rock era is the album. Stephen, you write this: albums still exist, but their existence feels precarious. What does the declining interest in the LP suggest about future interest in classic rock?
Well, you know, it's interesting because when we talk about how music is packaged, whether it's on a 45 single, whether it's on the LP or on a CD or now in the streaming format, I mean, you really see how the technology shapes the way the music is made. You know, when singles were the thing, the focus was on creating like the perfect 2.5 minute song. You know, that was the focal point for most popular artists. And then the LP came into play, and you know, someone smart in the record industry figured out that, well, we can charge more for LPs, so we ought to maybe promote artists who are more geared toward making LPs because we'll make more money that way. And that was a very successful gambit for them. And then it became the thing of, well, we're going to put five songs on each side of this LP and we're going to structure our musical statements in that way. Like, that is going to be significant. And then CDs, of course, albums get longer. You know, you get 70 and 80-minute albums in the 80s and 90s. And now we have this streaming situation where artists are starting to make like 20 and 30-track albums, you know, that don't really have the feel of a cohesive record. Because the more streaming stats that you rack up, the higher you end up, you know, on the pop charts, you know. So you're sort of encouraged to pack more songs. You know, quantity sometimes over quality really pays through in the streaming era. But, you know, to go back to the issue about classic rock, you know, the thing that I find, you know, I interview a lot of musicians, and one thing that they bring up over and over again is that, you know, they know that if they put out a record, that listeners aren't necessarily going to listen to it in the order that they laid it out. Mm-hmm. You know, that they're going to pull out songs that they like and put them into playlists.
Right.
But they still make records because they like records and that they were raised on records. You know, and they grew up listening to Led Zeppelin 4 and The Dark Side of the Moon and Born to Run and all these classic albums. And they always want to make their own version of that. You know, they want to be part of that lineage. So as much as I feel like sort of commercially or in the popular listening, you know, the way that we listen to music, people aren't necessarily thinking about albums. I think they'll continue to exist because artists will wave the flag. And there's always going to be a minority of listeners who care about this stuff, the people that buy vinyl.
Right.
Fueling the vinyl, which, you know, vinyl's never going to be, it's never going to usurp streaming. It's never going to be as big as that. But there will be, I think, always a sizable group of people who care about this stuff, and that'll be enough to keep it going.
Stephen Hyden is my guest. His book, Twilight of the Gods. Let's go to some phone calls. Kevin from Kansas City, Missouri. Kevin, you're on Up to Date.
Hi there. Good morning and great show. Respectfully, I think you're over-romanticizing, in the first place, classic rock. Kind of, to an extent, classic rock is whatever kind of you grow up with. And believe me, I'm about the age of you, Mr. Kresge. And, you know, classic rock for me is Led Zeppelin and you know, so many things. And that's great. But respectfully, you're missing a lot here. In the first place, the current situation frees up both the listeners, but also the artists. So they're more in control of both their own music and their own music destiny. And if you listen to, you know, find things like, for instance, Kaleo right now, this Icelandic group that somehow, thank God, ended up in Austin, Texas, and they're playing this incredible stuff, incredible steel string guitar, incredible vocals. It's extremely freeing and puts us more in charge of our own music. It's fantastic, and I am loving it.
Stephen, you want to respond?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with all that. I'm not refuting any of that. You know, like I said in the book, like I said before, there's elements in my book where I'm sort of romanticizing this because it's what I grew up with, but I'm also critiquing it at the same time. And like I said before, you know, if you had told me as a kid that I could have Spotify, I would take Spotify. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think what's interesting now, you know, is I think the way young people think about music, it's much different than what we're maybe traditionally used to thinking about music. I know when I interview young musicians, there's not the old separations that exist anymore, whether it's between genres or between eras. Because in a way, the internet flattened music history. You know, it wasn't a matter of the way it was in the old days where there would be a trend that was really popular for a while, and that's all you heard on the radio. And because the radio was the only thing that existed, that's the thing that we all listened to, you know, whether it was hair metal or synth pop or grunge or gangster rap or whatever. All those things can exist at the same time now because they're all equally accessible. So if you look at the average young person's playlist, they're going to have a little bit of hip-hop, they're going to have some rock,
right,
they're going to have country music, they're going to have, you know, maybe some old blues stuff. They're going to have some jazz. They're going to have classic rock. And I think that is an improvement. You know, and another thing about my book, too, I mean, it's called Twilight of the Gods. It's not called The Gods Should Live Forever. It's not called This Music Is Going to Be Around Forever. It's about the end of an era. And a big part of that era was sort of this white male Superman myth that
was
big in classic rock.
Cut in here, Stephen, because you acknowledge towards the end of this book that the old classic rock myth about the white male Superman who pursues truth via decadence and virtuosic displays of musicianship has run its course. And it's time now, you write, for new legends. Was that a tough conclusion for you to reach here?
No, it's not, because I think, you know, the thing I've always loved about rock music is the continuum of music, the idea that everything is connected, that you can listen to an artist now and feel connected to something that happened 50 years ago. It's all a link in the chain. And I think it's great to celebrate the past, but you can't live in the past. You have to live in the present. You have to look to what is happening now and what's exciting now. And I think for rock fans, there's a lot of excitement in terms of how many women are leading rock bands now, how many black and brown musicians are leading rock bands now. It's much more welcoming for LGBTQ musicians now. And that's what I talk about, like, with the new legends. You know, these are the new people that are taking this music forward and taking it in different directions, musically and also culturally. Like, I think of a person like Courtney Barnett, you know, who I think is writing the best. She's like the best lyricist of rock songs on the planet right now. And you look at her and, like, she kind of has like a Keith Richards haircut. She plays left-handed guitar like Jimi Hendrix. But she's also like a sardonic lesbian from Australia, you know, who writes these great songs about, you know, sort of the minutiae of life. She's really observant. And if you love rock and roll, you can hear the roots of it in her music. But she's also taking it in a totally different direction. And there's lots of artists like that that are working today. So that's exciting to me. You know, that is what...
Right.
But you know, like... so, again, I feel like this book, it's a... I call it an affectionate critique of classic rock history. It's something that I love because I was raised with, and I still have a lot of affection for it. But I think it's also a pretty sober, realistic look at where it stands now.
Again, our guest, Stephen Hayden, his book, Twilight of the Gods, A Journey to the End of Classic Rock. You know, you went to a lot of rock concerts, including one by The Who in 2012 outside of Chicago to prepare to write this book, which sounds like a great gig. You write that they were both incredible and at the same time very, very old. Of lead singer Roger Daltrey, you write, when he tried to scream the iconic yelp at the climax of Won't Get Fooled Again, he sounded like a granddad hacking the gunk out of his throat. What was your takeaway from that experience?
Well, that was a concert that inspired the book in a way, because I loved The Who when I was a teenager. I mean, they were a band that I loved because bands that I loved them. Like Pearl Jam loved The Who, and they would talk about The Who, and that helped get me into listening to Quadrophenia and Who's Next and The Who Sell Out and all those great records. So certainly I knew going into the concert that, like, they weren't that band anymore. I knew that they weren't, you know, still in their 20s in 1971. But, you know, when you come to classic rock the way I did, they were a band that existed in my imagination. You know, I watched documentaries about them. I stared at album covers. So in a way, they kind of were frozen in ember for me. So to see them perform, I mean, it was a great thrill, but it was also a realization that, like, wow, these guys, well, first of all, half the band is gone. John Entwistle and Keith Moon have long since passed away. But, you know, Daltrey and Townsend, you add up their ages, and it was like 140 years old. And you just realize, like, wow, this time is coming. Like, these people that have been sort of like monuments in our culture, they're getting up to a certain age where they will not be around anymore, either because they retire or they'll be passing away. So, you know, that was 6 years ago when I started thinking about this. But it wasn't really until, like, the last couple years where I feel like this was in sort of the front of mind for everybody. And I think it started with David Bowie in 16. I think that was a really shocking passing for a lot of people. And then Prince. And then, of course, there's been a whole series since then. Greg Allman, Tom Petty, Glenn Frey.
Well, before we get away from the Who too far, let's play a little bit of some classic rock here. This is The Who and Won't Get Fooled Again.
Thank you.
Now, I'm running out of time here. I want to grab a phone call from Richard from Overland Park. Richard, that is classic rock and roll, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And it's, even though it's stuff I grew up with, I happen to think it's some of the best music ever written from the, you know, the stuff from the 60s and 70s. To me, I won't argue the mechanism that your author's been talking about or the other caller's been talking about it.
Right.
But I think the quality of it, it was like a dam breaking when the birth, when rock and roll came out. The 50s were a little different. They still had kind of the beautiful music sound. But when the 60s and 70s came forward, it was just like a dam bursting of creativity that had been kind of bottled up.
That's interesting.
We're still listening to it now, and it gets new converts every day. I just can't see the music from the 80s and the 90s being played on a classic station 50 years from now.
Yeah.
I don't think that's going to happen. And even though I'm tied to it because of it's what I grew up with in the 70s, I think it has a tremendous resonance to it that there are periods in time, history, where there were tremendous outpourings of art.
Richard, I'm going to have to cut you off. I'm sorry. I've got to run. The book again from Stephen Hayden, Twilight of the Gods, A Journey to the End of Classic Rock. Stephen, thanks so much. I sure appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Tomorrow, it's our second conversation about tax incentives used to develop downtown Kansas City. This time, we'll hear from tax increment financing supporters. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.